Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward. Today, I'll continue reading from the April 2026 issue. First up is State of Nature, What Are Conserve Environmentalists Fighting For? By Gabby Del Valle. After the humiliation of defeat, we look to the 26th president for solace. Teddy Roosevelt says, "Let me find the part that matters," said Casey, our team captain, struggling to catch her breath as she scrolled on her phone. The man who matters actually strives to do the deeds, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devastations, spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows in the end the triumphs of achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails by doing greatly, she read. That's what I want to see on the kickball field. In her zeal, she had mangled part of Roosevelt's Man in the Arena speech, but we got the point. That day, we had known the great enthusiasms. We had vanquished our competitors at tug of war and bested our enemies on the dodgeball court. But we had also failed to fill a bucket with water faster than our opponents. Though my teammates were dehydrated and slightly red in the summer heat, they were not demoralized. We'd made it to the playoffs, where we would redeem ourselves. Of the 200 or so young conservative environmentalists gathered at Tennessee's Montgomery Bell State Park for the annual summit of the American Conservation Coalition, we were among the lucky few who would get to play kickball. Even I, the lone journalist in attendance, was not immune to team spirit. Still, I ceded my spot on the roster to a 20-something from Indiana who spent the better part of the past 48 hours alternately antagonizing and avoiding me. The previous morning, as I sat in the back of a glittery blue paddle boat, he'd glided past me with a hand over his face, as if shielding himself from paparazzi. But he was friendlier today, telling me that he'd overslept and missed most of field day. Kickball was his last shot at some wholesome outdoor fun before a long afternoon of talks and breakout sessions. Who was I to deny him that? In the end, our team wound up a player short, and my sacrifice proved unnecessary. When we won, the young Hoosier picked me up and spun me around. Hostility had given way to camaraderie. Inspired by Roosevelt's example, we were gracious in our victory. I walked the line with my teammates, high-fiving the other players, among them a flack for the outgoing Virginia governor, Glenn Youngkin, repeating, good game, like a spell. It was day three of the ACC summit, and Teddy's specter had loomed over the proceedings. Here was a man who'd hunted buffalo and then dedicated himself to saving the species from extinction, who fought to acquire distant colonies while protecting some 230 million acres of public lands at home, who, while leading the Rough Riders in Cuba during the Spanish-American War, made time to write to his daughter Ethel about the ground doves and cuckoos at his campsite. It was no wonder that the ACC, a sort of Sierra Club alternative for young conservatives, had adopted him as its intellectual godfather. After the morning's field day activities, we gathered for an all-American lunch of burgers and hot dogs. Over the meal, Matt Briney, the chief communications officer at the new Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library, recounted the story of how Roosevelt, paralyzed by grief after the concurrent deaths of his first wife and his mother in 1884, retreated into the wilderness and discovered his life's purpose. The Badlands made him a conservationist, not out of sentimentality, but out of first-hand experience, Briney told the audience of Zoomers, several of whom were looking down at their phones. He watched as market hunting and unregulated expansion pushed species toward extinction. He understood that if we didn't protect these places, progress would devour the very beauty that made America unique. Briney implored us to ask ourselves what kind of future we were building for those who will come after us. Nature is not partisan, he said. Responsibility is not partisan. Leadership is not partisan. They are Rooseveltian. The American Conservation Coalition, on the other hand, is partisan, and explicitly so. It was founded by Benji Backer in 2017 when he was a freshman at the University of Washington. Despite his youth, Backer was already a seasoned conservative operator. He had volunteered for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign in 2012, appeared on Megyn Kelly's show as a teenage Tea Party supporter the following year, and railed against teachers' unions, the mainstream media, and the failed leadership of Barack Obama in a speech at the 2014 Conservative Political Action Conference. When he founded the ACC, however, Backer softened his tone, challenging some of the right-wing dogma he'd previously embraced. In a 2017 interview with CNBC, he criticized Republicans for diminishing the issue of climate change and urged them to alter course, if not for the good of the planet, then at least to win over young voters. That didn't mean he was ready to join hands with liberals, whom he accused on one occasion of doing more harm than climate deniers by throwing their weight behind unrealistic and alienating policies. Instead, Backer's group advocated for a third way between denialism and decarbonization. Common sense, limited government environmentalism, as he put it. While the nascent ACC did not advance many policy proposals, the group's early platform included calls to stand up for sportsmen's rights and emphasize the role that private industry could play in creating a diverse set of renewable energy options. 9 years on, the ACC has grown from little more than a blog into a national network of almost 100 branches, complete with a lobbying arm, a few dozen full-time staffers, a $5 million operating budget, and close allies in the White House. The organization counts the Interior Secretary, Doug Burgum, and the Energy Secretary, Chris Wright, both of whom participated in ACC events before appointment to their current positions, among its powerful supporters. And yet, such prominence doesn't seem to have led to many tangible benefits for the environment. Since Donald Trump reassumed office last January, the Environmental Protection Agency has tried to narrow the scope of the Clean Water Act. The Department of the Interior has weakened the Endangered Species Act and has authorized oil and gas drilling in an untouched region of Alaska. The National Park Service has lost nearly one quarter of its permanent staff. The Department of Agriculture has proposed rescinding a rule that limits logging on federal lands, and the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which a Trump administration official once denigrated as a source of climate alarmism, has been gutted. I won't try to sugarcoat it, a former Sierra Club president told the New York Times last year regarding the administration's attacks on environmental protections. This is a generational loss. Given the ACC's frequent evocation of the sublime, ancient glaciers, sun-dappled forests, purple mountain majesties, and all the rest, I wondered whether its members or leadership harbored any sense that they'd been betrayed by a president whose environmental policy could best be described as one of unmitigated extraction. Was the group valiantly countering the White House's efforts to destroy what's left of the land they claimed to love? Or was the lack of legislation that even hinted at a green agenda under the second Trump administration a sign that the ACC's true aims lay elsewhere? On the first day of the ACC summit, while attendees were still being shuttled from Nashville to the lodge at Montgomery Bell, the hotel where it was taking place, I decided to check out the organization's Market Environmentalism Academy, a series of free online classes on everything from advanced recycling and natural gas 101 to the role of hunters and anglers in conservation. From my hotel room in nearby Dixon, the ACC had given me a press pass on the condition that I find lodgings elsewhere, I got a crash course on the philosophical roots of environmentalism from Mike Leavitt, who had headed the EPA under George W. Bush. On my screen, he was framed by floor-to-ceiling windows that offered a view of Salt Lake City and the snow-capped Wasatch Range. Conservative environmentalism, Levitt said, is rooted in four principles: continuity, beauty and aesthetics, civil society, and oikophilia, a term coined in the early aughts by the English philosopher Roger Scruton that means love of home. Oikophilia suggests that those connected to specific landscapes by virtue of their birth or ancestry are uniquely capable of appreciating them. People love the land because it's theirs. They will someday hand it down, like a family heirloom, to their children. The module ended with a quiz, the final question of which was, who said society is a partnership of the dead, the living, and the unborn? To my surprise, the correct answer was not Scruton, but Edmund Burke. One of the ACC's refrains, articulated across its official communications, is that liberal environmental activists have co-opted what is fundamentally a right-wing cause, an outlook neatly summed up by one of its posters, which depicts a piranha Donald Trump astride a bison. Conservation, it reads, is conservative. Last October, Danielle Franz, the ACC CEO, argued the point in more detail on the organization's Substack named The Bully Pulpit in homage to Roosevelt. No longer can we allow loud progressive protesters to claim the moral high ground on caring for creation, she wrote. In her telling, modern environmentalists who favor litigation and red tape over hands-on care for the land have besmirched the legacy of authentic outdoorsmen like Roosevelt, who pioneered the stewardship of America's natural bounty for the benefits of the American people. In place of conservation, the active tending of nature, a rigid preservationism has taken root, one that confuses neglect for virtue and sidelines the human role in keeping the land healthy and alive. Franz's language harks back to a debate that divided the burgeoning U.S. conservationist movement in Roosevelt's day. After the San Francisco earthquake and ensuing fires of 1906 destroyed most of that city's buildings and jeopardized its water supply, Roosevelt's Secretary of the Interior set in motion the damming of the Hetch Hetchy Valley on the northern edge of Yosemite National Park to create a lasting water and energy source for Northern Californians. The battle over Hetch Hetchy's fate drove a wedge between Roosevelt and the Sierra Club's founder, John Muir, who lamented the destruction of the sublime and beautiful valley and is said to have died of heartbreak after Congress authorized the dam's construction. The two became emblems of a schism. On the one side were utilitarian conservationists who prioritized natural resource management. On the other were strict preservationists who argued that scenic landscapes should remain as free as possible from human intervention. As the ACC has it, these factions persist today, mapping onto the right and the left, respectively. And while the conservationists may have won the battle over Hetch Hetchy, they lost the war for the soul of the environmental movement, which, in the words of the ACC's president, Chris Barnard, now champions a disordered philosophy of degrowth that discourages the consumption of resources required to build, produce, and ultimately live. This conflation of decarbonization, which involves phasing out fossil fuels and investing in renewable energy, with the niche ideology of degrowth, whose proponents advocate reducing economic activity to remain within ecological limits, allows the leaders of the ACC to position themselves as the reasonable ones. The group intends to reinvigorate a tradition outlined on its website, which traces a history of conservative environmentalism from Ulysses S. Grant's establishment of Yellowstone National Park in 1872 to the ACC sponsorship of the 2024 Republican National Convention. The intervening years include a description of Teddy's conservation legacy, Richard Nixon's creation of the EPA, Ronald Reagan's underappreciated role in the ratification of the Montreal Protocol, an international treaty that worked toward the elimination of ozone-depleting substances, and George H.W. Bush's signing of amendments to the Clean Air Act in 1990 that significantly expanded the original law. Things pick up speed with the founding of the ACC in 2017. There is Trump's signing of the Great American Outdoors Act in 2020, the formation in 2021 of the Conservative Climate Caucus in the House of Representatives, and the time that an ACC member asked a question about climate change at a Republican presidential debate in 2023 that Trump did not participate in. This history hardly adds up to a coherent political program. Indeed, many of these developments have no meaningful connection to conservatism at all. They simply happen to have occurred during Republican administrations. Bush's Clean Air Act amendments, for example, were supported by bipartisan majorities in both the House and the Senate, while Nixon's EPA is now being sabotaged by its current Trump-appointed administrator, Lee Zeldin. Even the ideology of the group's patron saint was more complicated than the ACC lets on. Roosevelt may have held conservative views on race, masculinity, and family making, but he was not the proponent of the limits to government that the group champions today. A coastal elite by any measure, he used executive orders to protect hundreds of thousands of acres of national forests, putting him at odds with farmers, ranchers, and loggers, figures who form a core part of the ACC's identity. Eventually, Roosevelt broke with the Republican Party altogether, running for president on the Bull Moose ticket in 1912, siphoning off votes from his old party and handing the election to Woodrow Wilson. "I have always believed," Roosevelt wrote to a friend that year, "that wise progressivism and wise conservatism go hand in hand." The more complex history of American environmentalism, which has always been marked by unlikely alliances and political reversals, hardly jibes with the binary that serves as a crucial part of the ACC's pitch. The preservationist left, the group claims, is willing to sacrifice American prosperity if it reduces the rise in global temperatures by even a tenth of a degree. The conservationist right, on the other hand, understands that man's dominion over nature is both a right and a responsibility. America's natural resources ought to be protected, but only in ways that support what various ACC spokespersons have repeatedly referred to as human flourishing. In this spirit, the ACC dismisses concerns about overconsumption, offering its members a vision of homegrown American plenty. A conservative approach to conservation is just one half of its platform. The other is devoted to promoting U.S. energy dominance by speeding the permitting process for new energy infrastructure and embracing an all-of-the-above strategy that does not discriminate against fossil fuels. Executives of oil, nuclear, and geothermal companies delivered 3 of the 9 keynote speeches at the ACC summit. Jonathan Webb, the founder of the nuclear company, a startup aiming to streamline the construction of nuclear reactors, addressed us during the opening night dinner. Sporting a pair of glasses with thick black frames and a mullet that wouldn't look out of place at the nearby Nashville Super Speedway, he got emotional while reminding his audience that 100,000 Americans have died mining coal. "Those men didn't make the ultimate sacrifice," Webb said, his voice quivering, "so that we can sit here at tables like these and talk about what the American people cannot do. My table mates gorged themselves on fried catfish while debating whether his tears were genuine." On energy policy, the ACC is virtually indistinguishable from the broader conservative establishment. The group is proudly capitalist and believes that the country needs a thriving energy industry to counter China's rising global power. Nor is there much daylight between its platform and that of such centrist enterprises as the abundance movement, which calls for prosperity through deregulation. What distinguishes the ACC's project is a kind of romantic nationalism that emphasizes the splendor of the American landscape and the moral values it symbolizes. while the liberal darlings Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson, whose book Abundance functions as a roadmap for the movement, want to build a solar punk future in which the denizens of nuclear-powered high-rises drink desalinated ocean water and obtain their celestially synthesized medications via drone, the ACC's image of the future looks a lot like the past. Traditional American families enjoying the great outdoors, hunting and fishing and camping as their forebears did, on land that is every bit as beautiful as it always had been. In this respect, the group's members can sometimes sound like the proponents of a brand of right-wing environmentalism they seem less eager to publicly reclaim. One represented by figures such as Garrett Hardin, the author of the seminal essay, The Tragedy of the Commons, or John Tanton, the founder of the far-right Federation for American Immigration Reform, who paired their love of American landscapes with an affinity for eugenics and a disdain for foreigners. Although the ACC hasn't commented publicly on immigration policy, the subtext of some of its imagery seems clear enough. In January, the group's Instagram account published a slideshow of men and women riding horses through dramatic scenery. In one case, while brandishing a gun, "Americans do it better," read the message superimposed on the first photograph. We protect what is good, true, and lasting within our homes, our communities, and our country, Franz wrote in her bully pulpit treatise. It has never been more important to reclaim our natural heritage, the land itself, as part of what we so passionately defend. For now, at least, that defense is mostly superficial. The ACC has scored a handful of modest policy wins. The group helped kill an amendment to the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that would have allowed the sale of some public lands, and it helped draft the Patriotic Parks Act, a bill introduced by the West Virginia Representative Riley Moore and the Montana Representative Ryan Zinke, that would charge foreign visitors higher entry fees at national parks. Brigham adopted such an America First pricing structure this past November. The group's highest profile victory was influencing the Make America Beautiful Again executive order that Trump signed last July, establishing a commission to advise and assist the president regarding how best to responsibly conserve America's national treasures and natural resources. Attendees at the ACC summit received green Make America Beautiful Again hats in their swag bags, which, rumor went, they were asked to don for a photo op requested by the president himself. So far, though, the MABA Commission's only public achievement appears to be the fact of its existence. At reception, I met Brandon, a gregarious biochemistry major at Ohio State University, who founded the ACC branch on his campus in 2022. Brendan had been scouted by a former ACC regional director and veteran of the Trump 2020 campaign while tabling for a carbon capture club at a sustainability fair. "The eco movement is a spectrum," he told me. "We engage whoever is willing to talk to us about that kind of thing." Brendan believes that the increasing frequency of natural disasters is helping to drive a political realignment. As the environmental cycles are getting worse for people, they're starting to realize it's a real issue, and it's moving up further on people's ballots, he said. Although this may not be true for older generations, polls do show that the environment is a key issue for Gen Z voters, regardless of political affiliation. A survey published in The Lancet in 2024 found that a majority of self-identified Republicans between the ages of 16 and 25 reported at least moderate distress about climate change. The ACC prides itself on steering clear of climate doom, but it's clear that the organization's green branding is a powerful recruiting tool. The organization now boasts more than 100,000 members across all 50 states, putting it on par with influential groups such as the Democratic Socialists of America, thanks to a field staff whose primary role is to start new branches of colleges and in cities around the country. The approach has endeared the ACC to young people who otherwise might not join a conservative group or participate in political organizing at all. A University of Florida engineering student at the summit, who told me that she's not political, said she got involved with the ACC because the group hosts trash cleanups on her campus. Sammy, another Ohio State student who describes herself as a leftist, said she signed up for every environmental club at the school during her freshman year and sporadically attended ACC events, participating in not super partisan activities like DIY soap making before she was aware of the group's political leanings. It's really easy when you're online all the time to have very polarized, angry conversations, Sammy said. But spending time face-to-face with people who hold different views than she does has made it easier for them to understand one another. The ACC's chief operating officer, Stephen Perkins, told me that the organization takes inspiration from the Obama-era liberal framework of youth engagement. But while Democratic-aligned groups now take young voters for granted, an oversight evident in that demographic shift to the right in the 2024 presidential election, the ACC is working to carve out a durable place for them in conservative politics. For a nominally environmentalist event, the summit had an unusual emphasis on professional development. Carly Tomain, the well-coiffed director of youth programs at the Leadership Institute, a sort of boot camp for conservative activists, gave a keynote address. Attendees could also join a breakfast session with Run Gen Z, a group that cultivates young Republican candidates for office. Never mind that Run Gen Z's parent organization, the American Legislative Exchange Council, is responsible for, among other things, drafting bills that would punish financial institutions and other companies for divesting from the fossil fuel industry. The point of the group's presentation was that Run Gen Z was willing to fly promising young conservatives to a conference in Clearwater, Florida, at the height of winter, free of charge. To facilitate connections among its rising stars, the ACC also gave attendees a journal with a section where they could record their new friends' contact information. For each visit to a sponsor's booth in the summit's exhibition area and each check-in at a breakout session, attendees received a stamp in their journal. Those who collected enough were rewarded with a limited edition plushie named Ricky the Reactor, an anthropomorphic cooling tower emitting a plume of white steam. His sparkling eyes and rosy cheeks were undeniably adorable. Some of you in the room are probably going to go on and do huge things, Tomain told her audience. There was no question that at least a few of the attendees wearing khakis and stand-up-for-sportsmen baseball caps aspired to power. At dinner one night, one of my precocious table mates bragged about attending an Inauguration Week party at which he'd asked the former U.S. ambassador to Venezuela why we haven't drone-striked Maduro yet. This comment proved to be somewhat prophetic. I'm sure he was thrilled about the Venezuelan president's capture in January. Broadly speaking, the young people I met at the ACC summit could be divided into three camps. Those who were there to network, those who were there to touch grass, like the aspiring botanist from Houston who said he planned to skip most of the breakfast sessions to go hiking, and those who were there to party. These categories weren't mutually exclusive. Some of the nature lovers had heard of the ACC through more overtly political clubs, such as the Young Republicans, the College Republicans, or Turning Point USA. And the same kids eager to make LinkedIn connections also talked about sipping Everclear by the pool. Throughout the summit, the networkers were, by and large, wary of me, a representative of the fake news media, evidently out to ruin their lives and stymie their future careers. Apart from one intrepid college freshman who asked me about internship opportunities at this magazine. Even their most innocent comments were made off the record, though some of the same attendees who'd refused to be formally interviewed did later request to follow me on Instagram. Few of them needed to attend the optional media training session in which ACC staff reminded the handful of students in the room that working journalists are not your friends, to understand that they should watch what they said around me. The session did come with a personalized exemption. Gabby, this doesn't apply to you. Gabby is great. At the closing reception, I wound up speaking to someone who said he'd been warned about me as we milled around the fire pit. He got a text letting him know he was talking to a reporter. You are listening to readings from the April 2026 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Emily, a libertarian from Colorado who has been involved with the ACC for several years, theorized that the divide among the members' priorities is regional. The DC branch, of which she was previously a member, is more into the politics side, she said. But the Denver branch is more into, like, national parks and regenerative farming. The ACC has tapped into not only climate anxiety, but also MAHA-inflected wellness concerns, some of them justified, about toxins in the food supply. Emily first got involved with the ACC when she attended a screening of Kiss the Ground, a Woody Harrelson-narrated Netflix documentary that criticizes pesticide use and other conventional agricultural practices, hosted by the ACC's Denver chapter. She was the only person who showed up, but she and the ACC rep had a great time talking about sustainable farming, and she signed up. The group is geared toward conservatives, Emily explained, but she likes that it attracts people in the middle and also people who lean slightly left but don't appreciate the fear-mongering tactics used by far-left environmentalists. Being part of the ACC made her feel as though she could make a difference. It reminded her that she has agency. In the months since the summit, her chapter has organized rock climbing events and policy discussions and distributed hand warmers and food to Denver's homeless population as part of a national ACC effort called Land That We Love. In her reference to fear-mongering, Emily was repeating, intentionally or otherwise, something of a party line. During our conversation at the summit, Perkins, ACC's COO, claimed that liberal climate organizations have leaned into not just doom and gloom, but almost perpetual victimhood. The ACC, he said, prioritizes making its members feel good and cultivating optimism about America's future by stressing the power of individual action. In encouraging its young acolytes to focus on their local communities, the group has also deftly directed their energy away from activism that emphasizes top-down structural change. Fittingly, the summit's resemblance to summer camp fostered a mood of compulsory cheer. After the opening night dinner, attendees were shepherded to a bonfire where we toasted s'mores and, to my chagrin, sang a round of campfire songs led by a spontaneously formed a cappella group that butchered various numbers by John Denver and Blink 182. In addition to field day, we could partake in activities like fishing, kayaking, and archery. One afternoon, an exceedingly accommodating employee of the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency taught me the proper technique for drawing a bow, reminding the men whose target practice I'd interrupted to be patient as I fiddled with my string. We were both surprised when I managed to shoot an arrow into a stuffed deer a few yards away. Once I got the hang of things, he suggested that we all try to hit the deer in unison. A girl waiting in a nearby lake observed the scene. "If things go haywire," she said dryly, "at least we have our own army." An air of rebellion permeated the summit as soon as the sun went down. One night featured a poolside movie screening, The Parent Trap, naturally, as we gathered around a projector to watch two Lindsay Lohan scheme to reunite their long-divorced parents. The more wayward among us snuck off to their rooms for unsanctioned fun. Later, by the elevator bank, I passed a stressed-looking ACC staffer who seemed to be on an important call. I know this guy is 20 because he told me today, she muttered into her phone, and he's got a Miller Lite in his hand. And the employees were stringent about checking IDs. I'd seen a different 20-year-old denied a cocktail because it contained trace amounts of alcohol. Yet some of the kids had found a way. Turns out you can DoorDash booze to the middle of a state park in Tennessee. Despite the ACC's best efforts, open disagreement occasionally spoiled the summit's kumbaya atmosphere. The ACC's policy director, Sarah Rosa, and its external affairs director, Isaiah Menning, hosted a breakout session dedicated to explaining the MABA agenda. The jury's still out on whether it's pronounced MABA or MABA. That was less of a collective victory lap than I had anticipated. Rosa told the audience gathered in a windowless conference room that Trump's Make America Beautiful Again executive order, which claims that his administration will prioritize maintaining national parks and restoring crucial ecosystems, was promoting voluntary collaborative conservation and trying to increase access to the outdoors so Americans can enjoy them. Flicking through a series of PowerPoint slides, she explained that MABA is about reclaiming pride in American landscapes and actually wanting to pass down our natural heritage for generations to come. It's a chance to reframe the entire conservation narrative around common sense and around a pro-human vision. While the left sees humans as a cancer on this earth, she said, MABA is all about humans being stewards of the environment. Even among the friendly crowd, there were a few skeptics. A lot of these actions still require personnel, and a lot of people involved with the national parks and environmentalism in general have lost their jobs due to the Department of Government Efficiency, one audience member pointed out. Another said he fears that by dismantling the EPA and other federal agencies and eliminating clean air and water regulations, the Trump administration was weakening anything that could actually make America beautiful again. How, he asked, do we reconcile with fellow conservatives who don't share our environmental goals? Put simply, where does MABA fit within MACA? Rosa and Manning were obviously unprepared for this line of questioning. The executive order, Manning said, furthers the two goals of increasing public access to recreation and recovering wildlife. The president has spoken on that, and this is an opportunity to do that. As for the DOGE cuts, Rosa took a long pause. I think we want our public lands to be protected and cared for and have the resources they need, she said. And we also want to make sure the government runs as efficiently as possible. Personnel, Menning conceded, are critical. Like, we need people to do all this stuff, and you need money to be able to hire them in a way that isn't, ideally, adding to the national debt. So finding creative ways to finance that are really important. These non-answers were typical of ACC leadership. We believe that conservation and economic development should work hand in hand, a spokesman told me in response to a question about the concerns raised at the MABA breakout session. Evasiveness is the cost of the organization's increasingly privileged place within conservative politics. The ACC takes pride in the fact that its members are more likely to intern on Capitol Hill than to protest there, and it seems unwilling to risk jeopardizing its numerous ties to the White House by openly criticizing the administration. If the ACC's goal was to halt Trump's assault on environmental protections, then those efforts have clearly failed. But if its object is, as Bernard put it to me, to build the conservative environmental movement, to grow its ranks and elevate its members to positions of influence in the Republican Party, then it has undoubtedly succeeded. What the group does with its seat at the table appears to be of secondary importance. A little less than a month after the ACC summit, I found myself at another crowded dinner table in another hotel, making awkward conversation with seatmates dressed in their business casual best. This time, however, I was about as far away as one can get, spiritually anyway, from the placid lakes and lush foliage of Montgomery Bell State Park, which is to say that I was in Washington. I'd come to the Capitol to join a motley crew of techno-populists, data-hungry political consultants, and a smattering of self-professed sewer socialists at the 2025 Abundance Conference. Among them was Chris Bernard, who would address attendees over the meal. The conference was a coming-out party for Klein and Thompson's pet project. Over the 6 months since the release of their book, Abundance's deregulation recommendations had been pitched as an inoffensive solution to any number of American ills, the housing crisis, declining economic productivity, and even issues like political polarization. Its proponents claim that the administrative burdens placed on everything from housing to energy infrastructure, once considered checks on the excesses of untrammeled capitalism, now serve primarily to impede progress. To build a decent future for everyone, they argue, we must first do away with onerous rules, regardless of whether they limit research into climate mitigation technology or block the construction of condos. Conference speakers and attendees alike agreed, for the most part, on the need for more housing, more energy, more jobs, and more prosperity, but they struggled to articulate a shared vision for how to get us there. More than one question and answer session devolved into a sparring match, yet, despite or because of its vagueness, Abundance has been embraced by many moderate Democrats as a panacea, one capable of countering Trumpism as well as the influence of the groups, activist organizations that Klein and others say have forced Democrats to commit to unpopular positions that alienate ordinary voters. But the movement doesn't offer much in the way of populist appeal itself. One speaker described Abundance as delivering utopianism through white papers. I was curious whether Bernard might finally be willing to acknowledge the right's environmental shortcomings outside the boosterist climate of the ACC summit, as some of his colleagues have done when addressing more liberal crowds. In October 2024, Danielle Franz gave a talk devoted to overcoming dilemmas in the green transition at a TED event in Brussels. She opened her remarks by asking the audience whether they had ever disagreed with their political party. "It looks like we are in pretty good company here," she said, when nearly every hand in the crowd shot up. A not insignificant part of her speech focused on acknowledging that Republicans have a lot of work to do when it comes to protecting the environment. Some conservatives, Franz admitted, were even claiming that climate change was a Chinese hoax. "What we really need to do," she went on, "is to work across the aisle, accept the findings of science, and reject purity tests." But a few months later, in an essay published in The Conservator, a new right-wing women's publication that wants to make America hot again, Franz's tone changed. She accused the left of having a stubborn fixation on climate change that has driven hunters and farmers, our original conservationists, away from the environmental movement altogether. While Franz tries to play both sides, the longtime conservative activist who founded the ACC is moving toward the center. Last summer, Benji Backer stepped down as the executive chairman of the organization's board to focus on his new initiative, Nature is Nonpartisan, a nonprofit that seeks to unite nascent right-wing conservationist outfits with more established groups. "We've kind of taken it upon ourselves to be the man in the arena, if you will," Amelia Joy, the communications director at Nature is Nonpartisan, told me, making a reference that is apparently irresistible to anyone in this line of work. The organization's launch event brought together a range of groups from across the political spectrum in Belforge, South Dakota, the exact geographic middle of the United States. The Abundance Conference, too, was a gathering of people who claimed to be seeking bipartisan alliances. Bernard was there to introduce Utah's Governor Spencer Cox, a Republican whose ambitious goal of building tens of thousands of new starter homes and embrace of cloud seeding technologies to combat water scarcity and restore the Great Salt Lake has made him an unlikely darling of the abundance movement. Rainmaker, a cloud seeding startup that contracts with the state of Utah, had a presence at the ACC summit. When he took the stage, however, I was surprised to find that Bernard didn't say much about pushing the right to embrace green policies or even finding common cause with his political rivals. Instead, he lavished praise on Cox for discovering a more meaningful application for the original abundance program. The governor's approach, Bernard said, is imbued with moral clarity. It is not about growth for its own sake or the endless proliferation of consumer goods, but about building more houses in which to raise children, harvesting more energy to safeguard their quality of life, and mitigating the bureaucratic meddling that gets in the way of both. The previous day, Barnard had formalized his pitch for a conservative framework for abundance in an essay published in the journal American Affairs. More pugnacious than his remarks at the conference in Washington, it falls just short of calling Klein and Thompson's vision of the future godless and degenerate. Their utopia, he notes, lacks a concern for the permanent things, namely family, faith, and tradition. Barnard also criticizes the authors for writing off the frontier as, in his words, a largely antiquated myth. Sounding like a 21st century Frederick Jackson Turner, he argues that we should revive the pioneer ethos because, as leaders like Theodore Roosevelt have long recognized, strenuous activity in the natural world is critical for the vitality of the citizen, and by extension, the nation. In other words, Americans won't build if they can't prove their mettle in new and uncharted territory. Barnard's invocation of the frontier isn't only symbolic. By harnessing the power of AI, he writes, we can even reintroduce megafauna like mammoths and bison to restore historic landscapes and reinstate long-standing cultural connections to those ecosystems. But considering that mainland North America's woolly mammoths disappeared 10,000 years ago, it's unclear what cultural connections he could be referring to. The convergence of abundance centrists and conservative environmentalists would seem to belie the ACC's assertion that the environmental movement is dominated by radicals who would rather sabotage the American economy than accept any of the compromises necessary to achieve a prosperous future. The truth is that the hardline activists of such groups as Extinction Rebellion were always marginal compared with the supporters of such sustainable development initiatives as the Green New Deal, and they have never been further from the levers of power. Not only were far-left organizations largely missing from the Abundance Conference in Washington, but Nature is Nonpartisan's events have often excluded even mainstream liberal groups like the Sierra Club and the Natural Resources Defense Council. To the extent that it has a national presence at all, preservationism has arguably become the domain of the right, as in Trump's war on wind turbines. They're killing the beauty of our scenery, our valleys, our beautiful plains, he said this past July during a meeting with the president of the European Commission. I'm not talking about airplanes. I'm talking about beautiful plains. More than their disdain for red tape, however, these movements share a tendency toward magical thinking. When it comes to the climate, they tend to disregard the urgency of the present to dream about the world to come or romanticize the mythic past. Abundance insists that no matter how much damage modern life has wreaked on the planet, we can reverse it without pain or sacrifice someday. Too many see clearly the costs that dirty energy can impose on the environment, but do not dare imagine the possibilities clean and abundant energy unlocks for it. Klein and Thompson write, before admitting that the fight against climate change will require technology that doesn't exist yet at scale. Trump's slashing of the provisions intended to fund clean energy projects and Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act has likely extended the timeline for developing any such technologies long enough to guarantee that global warming will exceed the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius that climate scientists have been warning us about for decades. The version of this program embraced by conservative environmentalists is even more fantastical, suggesting that, with enough entrepreneurial spirit, we can literally turn back time to when men were men, families came first, and Americans were outnumbered by herds of wild buffalo in landscapes of unblemished majesty. Not even Roosevelt believed in such fairy tales. In May 1908, he held the first conference of governors at the White House, an event that brought together state leaders, industrialists, and conservationists to chart a national conservation policy that would balance environmental protection and economic development. We have become great in a material sense because of the lavish use of our resources, and we have just reason to be proud of our growth, Roosevelt told the assembled crowd. But the time has come to inquire seriously what will happen when our forests are gone, when the coal, the iron, the oil, and the gas are exhausted, when the soils shall have been still further impoverished and washed into the streams, polluting the rivers, denuding the fields, and obstructing navigation. Roosevelt did not mince words when it came to the stakes of accepting and planning for finitude, even at the risk of angering the businessmen in his audience. We have to, as a nation, exercise foresight for this nation in the future, he said. And if we do not exercise that foresight, dark will be the future. Gabby Del Valle is a policy reporter at The Verge. Her first book, Blood and Soil, is forthcoming next year from Bloomsbury. Now, from the Harper's Archive, 1936, is Aliens in America by Louis Adamek. Ellis Island used to be one of the liveliest, most colorful places in the world. In 1910, 70,000 immigrants passed through it each month, and Americans proudly spoke of their country as a melting pot. But thanks to the post-war anti-alien hysteria and the deportation laws enacted during and soon after the First World War, the island's business has become the expulsion of foreigners. The alien himself is no menace to anything sound in the land. There are elements connected with the alien problem, however, that constitute an extremely ugly mess, which is perilous to America. This peril is due to the fact that Americans, by and large, including many legislators, are misinformed about the alien question, while professional patriots exploit it to their strange ends. In this, the patriots are aided by racketeers who trade in patriotism, by bombastic, narrow-minded labor union lobbyists, by obscurantist newspaper and magazine publishers and editors, by hack journalists eager to put their names to anything that sells, by would-be politicians promoting their personal aspirations, and by a few members of Congress seeking national publicity. Together, these individuals bedevil lawmakers with their flag waving and their exaggerations about the alien problem. They impede the intelligent efforts of experienced public servants whose job it is to address it, and they obstruct those working for sensible legislation needed to cope with it. They do what they can to spread alien hatred and, through it, the mutual distrust of American citizens of diverse racial and national strains. They seek to induce a government to violate America's traditions of fairness, decency, humanity, and tolerance, thereby increasing the complexity of our social, cultural, and spiritual condition in the near and distant future, lessening her ability to deal with it democratically, and threatening to inflict upon her certain characteristics of fascist European states. In a nutshell, it is these people who are the menace, not the alien. During the last half of the Hoover regime, the Department of Labor, which includes the Immigration and Naturalization Service, might well have been called the Department of Immigration and Deportation. Infected by the anti-alien virus, the Labor Secretary, William N. Doak, drew a strange satisfaction out of hounding immigrants, raiding homes, wedding parties, and other gatherings where it was suspected that a foreigner illegally in the country might be present, arresting aliens and others without warrant and requiring them to prove they were here legally. Keeping people in detention or under heavy bail for months and subjecting them to cross-examination, tearing husbands from wives and fathers from children who were either American citizens or legal residents, and deporting them. In many cases, the deportations were marked by a cruel disregard for human values that, one may assume, few members of Congress had intended when they enacted the expulsion laws. Doak and the Immigration and Naturalization Service have been sharply criticized, especially by social workers who came into contact with families left destitute because their breadwinners had been deported, often for technical irregularities that were not their fault, but the government's. The alien baiting of 15 years ago was an aftermath of the war madness, a symptom of general post-war uneasiness and disorientation. The current xenophobia is a product of the socioeconomic crisis of this decade and of the fear among the dominant economic and cultural groups of mass unrest or even revolution. This fear leads them to think and act in ways wholly out of line with traditional Americanism. In such a situation, scapegoats are needed, and the alien is the ideal one. The alien problem lends itself readily to fascist patriotic exploitation, in which facts and ideas are used to obscure bigger issues. Such exploitation becomes the starting point of movements whose aims and effects may ultimately be disastrous for America as a whole. From Aliens and Alien Baiters, which appeared in the November 1936 issue of Harper's Magazine. Thanks so much for joining me for this hour of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's readings have been from the April 2026 issue. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and hoping that you'll join me again next time.